coming to you live every Thursday, 4 p.m. for Greenhorn Radio. I am thrilled to be here with you and joined on the phone today by Jude Becker in Iowa. Jude, are you there?
I am here, Severin.
Hey, Jude, make sure you keep talking really loud so we can hear each other.
Okay.
Welcome on the show. Nice to have you here.
And thanks. Thanks so much for having me on.
So tell me, Jude, would you mind telling our audience a little bit about who you are and where you are and what you raise?
I am a farmer from Iowa, and we are producing organic pork at my sixth generation farm near Dyersville, Iowa. And we organic for us simply means that the pigs are living outdoors, and they are eating a diet of organic grain and being fed without the use of antibiotics. And we also follow a fairly strict regimen of animal welfare protocols that prohibit practices like tail docking and teeth cutting and have a lot to do with the space requirements so that it kind of sets us apart from more traditional indoor farms.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sometimes when I can't hear you, then I just start talking. This is pork that that even Willie Nelson would approve of.
That's right, that's right. I think he would be a great proponent of the pork we're producing.
Tell me, were you raised as an organic pork producer, or is this something that you found on your own?
I was raised on a traditional pig farm in Iowa that was not certified organic, but we were very much contrarians in the sense that we were producing pigs without subscribing to the modern confinement systems and not using antibiotics. And so when I went to Iowa State University and sort of sought a career path, organic livestock production seemed like a very viable option. Although in its infancy at the time, we converted our farm to become officially certified organic. And so it's something I've learned over the last, let's say, 10 years.
And so we know that the demand for local food and food that has got less miles and chemicals and pain associated with it has a growing market in New York City and in San Francisco. But what would be the challenges for someone who isn't quite so close into those ready markets for pastured pork products?
Well, that's a great question, Severin.
Tell me what the food chain looks like from your end.
That's a great question. We really try to find ways to connect with consumers that share our philosophy. So although not everyone lives in a great or greater metropolitan area, our website, BeckerLaneOrganic.com, offers shipping options for people who wish to share in our meat but don't live in such a great area. But you've outlined a great challenge to the local livestock producer movement in the United States, and that being just the shipping of these products. And it raises so many questions about the use of fossil fuels and associated food miles. And so I don't claim to have all the answers for those questions, but definitely we're searching for as many options as possible for consumers anywhere who want to share in our meat products.
You have potentially, I think, some local eaters there. I mean, there are some people who do live in Iowa, even though the population density isn't quite as high as it is in other places. And do you have local processing facilities? Tell us about those.
Yeah, we are fortunate. There are some restaurants in Iowa and Illinois who buy pork from our farm. But on the processing end, we're actually quite fortunate. There are several scaled and organized slaughter plants near my farm, which gives me great flexibility and many options for harvesting animals, breaking the carcasses down in a humane fashion, and achieving balanced use of the carcass. So in other words, we can break a pig in my case down into the primals, and which are the loin and the shoulders. And because of these processing plants and their shipping options, we can send away parts like the back legs, which you may know as ham, to, for example, a company called La Quercha, who does a great job making prosciutto, and they're also located in Iowa. So Iowa is sort of the center of the meat universe, as it were. So that's, although we aren't located immediately next to a great metropolitan area, we are located sort of in the center of the meat universe, so we can enjoy the options that these processing facilities give our farm.
Okay, so before we get too excited about how great all this work is that we're seeing on all these beautiful young farmer farms around America, tell me what the center of the meat universe looks like on the darker side of things.
Well, that's a good question. I'm definitely, as I said, a kind of a contrarian, and the neighborhoods, you know, the neighborhoods around me and my neighborhood are largely dominated by farmers who are either producing commodity corn that depends so much on fossil fuel-derived fertilizers, and most of that corn is being fed to either pigs or feedlot beef on some rather large, you may say, industrial confinement animal factory operations near me. So I do tend to cause a bit of a ruckus in the neighborhood when people see pigs roaming around outdoors, and I get a few comments from the neighborhood, you know, wondering why someone who's young like me is going back to the way it was done 50 years ago, and that it seems rather backward to them. But I think it's not only a throwback approach. It's maybe you could use the word postmodernism, because we are using some old-fashioned ideas, but I think they're very sound ideas. And along with those ideas, we're using a very modern marketing system to get our story out to people who share our philosophy.
Well, I mean, this is the thing is, you know, some of those commodity guys, they use, like, GPS and lasers, which is, you know, real high-tech, but it seems like the social engagement and the communication, the sophistication of farm design that young farmers are employing in their business structures are, in fact, potentially much more kind of refined technologies, you know, than the lasers and the glyphosate.
Right. I think it's important that a farmer never becomes a tool of his tools. So although it may seem, you know, really high-tech, as you said, to have, you know, GPS-driven combines and tractors, those tools actually do much more for the designers of those machines, such as the companies that engineer them, or for example, the Roundup Ready genes that are in our grain crops do a lot more benefit for Monsanto than they do for any of the farmers. And so I think the system I have is smart. If you can't say high tech, it's very smart, at least in a way that benefits farmers.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about how raising pastured pork is of benefit to you and your lifestyle. Describe for us, if you will, the conditions of your day, and what are you doing every day?
Well, my day at the farm starts very early. Typically, on long days, we try to get ahead of the heat, so we do chores maybe starting at 5:30 a.m. And I have four people on the farm helping me, because we have over 500 sows at my farm. So they're in several pasture fields spread over about 400 acres. And we begin the routine in the morning by feeding all of our sows a mixture of corn and soybeans and minerals in our pastures. And following that, we work through our farrowing department, and that just means the area where the baby piglets are. And then we have every day a routine for breeding. So we divide our work schedule in 21 days, and in each of those 21 days, a group of sows goes through its sort of through its paces, and that means breeding all the females or the sows. And some of those sows are giving birth, and some of the sows are having their litters of piglets weaned away from them. So there's a fairly strict routine that we go through to make each day sort of as productive as possible.
Tell me, what kind of pigs are you raising? And describe, if you would, what is the character of a pig? For those of us who are not, I'm recently acquainted with pigs because I have now two of my own pastured pigs. But I'm very much enjoying getting to know the character of the pig, and I think some of our radio listeners may as well.
Well, I think if you have been hanging around with pigs, you'll know that a pig is probably the only animal that looks at you as an equal. Whereas you could say cats look down on people and dogs look up to us, pigs look at us as though we're equal companions. And I think that's fascinating, and it's a fascinating backdrop for all of the ethics and morality of livestock keeping. But the specific pigs we have on our farm are Berkshire and Chester White breeds. And the Berkshire breed, as you or listeners may know, is sort of revered throughout the last few centuries for its great meat quality and hardiness. The Chester White breed may be a bit more obscure. It's another heritage breed of pigs. It's completely white, but it's very strong-boned, and so it's also very hardy. And we've chosen Chester White sows to become our mothers to make up the sow herd. And our boars are Berkshires, and so the resulting pigs that we choose to grow and harvest for meat are 50% Chester White and 50% Berkshire.
So those are English pigs.
Originally,
pig,
yes.
Tell us a little bit, if you can, about the history of the domestic pig, because it seems like in America, many, many of the pigs that we're raising are English pigs, also of the cattle that we're raising. But
right,
the history goes a lot further than that.
Right, you're right. The most pigs are come from lines of genetics that go straight back to England. So, yes.
Can you hear me when I'm saying, do you know a little bit about the early domestication of the pig? Because I think that there's something about a wild boar from Eurasia crossing with a wild boar from... I've forgotten about that.
I do know. I don't know very much about it, but I'm sure you're right.
Well, we need to do some research. We're going to get back to this pig issue in the next episode, but for the meantime, I'm going to go and make sure some research happens. Apparently, there's a wonderful book called Pig Perfect that has much description of such issues. So for those of you who are interested in doing some piggy research, that may be a good place to start, and I will... I will make sure we get back to the provenance of the pig in a later episode. Tell me, Jude, tell me about your marketing savvy and what you've learned, like what you're doing now and kind of how you got there.
Well, at the moment we are selling our pork to restaurants, primarily in California, also Chicago. And these are restaurants that we feel share our philosophy. And I have gotten to this point of directly dealing with chefs at these restaurants after a number of years of trial and error with various distributors. And I think the food chain that I want to participate in is working best when there's as few middlemen as possible. So making, as I said before, a pathway that connects the farmer and his philosophies and his worldview and his way of producing food to a given consumer or chef who shares those philosophies. And just getting rid of all that middle nonsense, it just makes the most sense for us. And I think it offers people the most value, especially in these rather arduous economic times. So it's taken me a number of years. Initially, we, you know, as I said, worked with distributors, but we found they didn't have the initiative to, or the true desire or the incentive to work with a small farmer, and they really just wanted to sort of play price games with us. And over time, we got connections with restaurants and chefs who were artisans like us and not just corporate middlemen. And so to make all that work from my farm in Iowa, I have a great helper in, for example, our helper Julie in California. And Julie is in charge each week of collecting orders from from all the restaurants that want to get pork for their menu of that week. And what we have a cutoff deadline, and as soon as I receive the pork orders from each restaurant via Julie, I decide how many animals we're going to harvest that week, and we set up a slaughter date at my slaughterhouse, and we take those pigs to be slaughtered and processed, and we ship the pork, and we actually share shipping with another group of natural pork producers to make it more economic and try to minimize the carbon footprint of our food miles. And so it takes about 7 days from the time the chef may place an order until they receive their pork. And that's sort of the gist of how we're marketing our pork at the moment.
Sounds like job creation to me. Sounds like young farmers are an engine of economic growth, both within and between these areas of production and consumption. Sorry,
right.
I'm making a joke. But
right,
I want to come back with some very important other things to talk about. After our slightly small break, we have to take a radio station break, and we'll return back with more with Jude Becker and Severin of the Greenhorns radio station. Talk to you in a second. This is Severin, and I'm back with Greenhorn Radio, radio for young farmers, by young farmers. I'm joined today on the telephone with Jude in Iowa. Jude Becker raises pastured pork products for markets around the country. He is a sixth-generation farmer and advocate for sustainable ag and animal welfare practices. Jude, I wanted to talk to you about the real politique of entry for other young farmers in the pork sector. I talked a little bit with Paul Willis about how young farmers might best join the ranks of the professional farmers, and he made the point to me that if you want to get started in factory pork production, there's not such a good likelihood that you'll be able to raise the capital to build a $500,000 concrete facility and raise confinement pigs, but that with pastured pigs, the investment in the startup capital is significantly lower, and you can kind of organically grow your herd and grow your operation, and of course have healthier pigs. Tell me what your insights might be about the role that your family's land and existing infrastructure played in your business, and how other people might expect
sure.
to succeed or struggle in the pork business.
Sure. Well, it's true that the amount of capital it takes to start an operation like mine is much less. And I think even more important than the amount of capital it takes is the fact that it's possible to start small and grow your business over time. So in my case, this is our 11th, well, maybe it's our 12th year of producing pastured organic pigs. And we've grown my farm from a beginning of six female gilts and one Berkshire boar in 1999 to what it is today. And we began small, and we didn't know very much. But that was okay because of the labor I put forward to create some wooden huts that sat in my pasture and offered shelter for the animals, and some of the other secondhand equipment I purchased initially that didn't take a lot of capital. It offered me a small beginning, and of course I couldn't make a living doing that, but over time we gained in knowledge and gained in the number of animals we could produce, and we found more supporters and more customers, and we grew our business. And so I'm sure that would be completely impossible in the modern corporate workings of industrial agriculture. So, for example, you know, as Paul mentioned or alluded to, it takes, I'm sure it could take multiple millions of dollars to construct a modern CAFO if someone wanted to build such a thing, which I don't. But, so definitely it's very true that it takes less capital and you can begin small and grow as you learn.
And it does help, it seems, also, then, if you are going to start small and you're going to work your way up into a kind of a business that will support you and sustain you as you build a family, that starting young has benefits not only in terms of the courage that you have when you're a young person to take on the impossible, but also that you have much lesser economic needs when you're a young person and you have more of that sweat equity on your side of the physical equation. Because in the beginning, you must have been working pretty hard getting all the fences in and getting your operation dialed.
It's true. I think for the first 2 years, I took very, very few days off of the routine on the farm, and I didn't have anyone helping me. And I can remember when we were big enough to have our first full-time employee, how much of an accomplishment it seemed to be, and I think it was, because that was sort of, you know, an indicator that we were becoming more substantial and more getting more traction.
It seems like although getting started in farming is always a bootstrap operation. Getting started in any business requires a certain amount of toiling. That the support hasn't necessarily been there from government institutions, from the government basically, to help with especially the startup loans that are needed. But recently, we've seen a big turnaround, and there are, this is for you young farmers listening now, there are quite a few programs out there which will help you with that startup capital. And I just thought I would quickly mention a few. One of the programs that I've just recently heard about is the Animal Welfare Institute's grant program. They have $5,000 and $10,000 grants that they're offering for folks who are wanting to do capital improvements on their farms. Specifically improvements that will help with, you know, moving animals onto pasture or improving the conditions of the lives of the animals. Those are grants for facilities upgrades. And there's also now a new USDA low-interest loan program, which you can read about on our blog, www.thegreenhorns.wordpress.com. Low-interest loans offered in many cases through something called Farm Start, which is a farm credit organization. A few new kind of green equity groups are pulling together resources to do investments by kind of green-minded investors in funds, which then move the money through farm businesses. Again, the example of Hardwick, Vermont keeps coming up, where a kind of consortium of farm businesses loan money to each other. There's a great project in Massachusetts called the Carrot Project that gets money going for startup businesses, on-farm processing, etc. Many other countries recognize the value of helping farmers capitalize their businesses and bring processing into the scale appropriate for that farm and for that kind of bioregions agriculture. In Ireland, you can get 50% cost sharing from the Department of Agriculture if you're doing on-farm processing of organic products. So beer, jam, cheese, etc. All of those food products require a certain amount of infrastructure, and that infrastructure is built with the help of federal monies in those countries. So there is certainly room for us to improve here in America the support that we provide to young entrepreneurs in the agricultural sector, people who are serving us food and serving us health. serving our soil and our streams and the quality of our children's lives. So tell me, Jude, what other programs you know about that are out there to help folks or resources that you tapped into in your journey?
Well, I also know of some of the programs you mentioned. We were fortunate enough to be a recipient of the Animal Welfare Institute Animal Welfare Grant in 2008. So that's helped our farm. I think that if you look at your local USDA farm office, and specifically the NRCS has a program called EQIP, which has a lot of funding right now from the USDA to support organic agriculture, and specifically people wanting to begin or transition land to organic farming. And in that transition guideline and definition, they have allowances for livestock operations. And I know there's been a fair amount of funding given to each state for that, and most people I've spoken with indicate there are very, very few farmers applying. So any young farmers out there listening who want to begin or in a certified organic operation should check with their local NRCS office and ask about EQIP, which I think could potentially
I just talked to my local NRCS officer recently because my landlord's doing some improvements on his farm that will be of benefit to kind of the aquatic health here in this landscape. So it was a very good experience. I think they have $50 million helping to support the certification costs even of farmers who are either getting recertified or transitioning from conventional to organic. One issue that I really wanted to make sure we covered before we ran out of time is the issue of breeding stock, and a little bit of your commentary would be appreciated about the decline in the quality. I don't want to put the words into your mouth. Tell me where you found your breeding stock and what you found about breeds in America today.
That's a great issue to discuss. The amount of available breeding stock is definitely being reduced, and the number of breeding stock providers, especially for pig producers, is very small and shrinking more every year. Because in order for a breeding stock farmer, in other words, someone who sells breeding stock, to be viable, they have to have a number of other farmers who can support them. And it seems as though the number of independent livestock producers has reached or is nearing a critical mass, going under that critical mass. And so I'm very fearful about the future in general of some of these breeds of animals, and especially pigs, and their availability for someone who would want to start a outdoor or pasture or organic livestock operation. In my case, I was fortunate enough in the year 2000 to make a connection with a breeding stock producer in Illinois. And he was a rather elderly gentleman that was in his 80s at the time and still trying to keep his breed of, or his specific line of Chester White breed pigs alive and viable. And since that time, I've taken ownership of most of his core genetics, so that we have the chance at my farm to continue those great hardy outdoor meat quality animals. But it's definitely a great issue of concern, and I think that we, you know, perhaps need to address the government for help, because I really am afraid that if we don't see some revitalization of breeding stock farmers, that we'll continue to see a decline in the number of breeds available for livestock farmers.
Sounds like another point for our policy platform for a young farmer-friendly farm bill. But would you ever consider being a breeder and providing that service to your local area?
Well, I think just by default, we have the possibility of offering several replacement females or boars for other farmers if they were to call me and ask and request that I save back some gilts, which are mate in sows or keep some boars intact for them, it's possible. But it's definitely not the same scale, and we can't offer the same consistency as a full-time replacement stock farm. We have actually in the past given or sold a few boars to other small farmers in my area who wanted to start their own breeds of Chester White pigs. So it's definitely something we've dabbled in.
Yeah, definitely. In the same way that the vegetable breeders, vegetable seed breeders, it's really a different genius, breeding seed and saving seed and watching the plants for their performance in that kind of astral way than it is doing production ag and serving the marketplace. It's often a very different sensibility of farmer, you know, different kind of farmer who will choose to focus in on those different aspects. So I would say it probably takes all types.
Absolutely, all types.
Well, we're getting to the end of our program, so I wanted to just make sure that you had a chance again to tell your website and any little bits of advice that you would offer to someone who's just getting started down this road, or maybe even to me because I only have two pigs. What would you tell me? And also mention some of those web addresses.
Sure. Well, I'll quickly give the web addresses. My farm's website is BeckerLaneOrganic.com. So it's just my last name, Becker, and the road we happen to live on is named Becker Lane. So it's BeckerLaneOrganic.com. Anyway, bits of advice for people getting into organic or pasture pig production. As I said before, try to begin small and find a market first. I often have people calling me up and telling me, oh shucks, you know, we can't market these pigs we've raised, and can't you help us? And it's very difficult to find a market for a pig weighing 300 pounds that, you know, should have been marketed 2 or 3 weeks or even a month ago, without having any planning done ahead of time. So definitely look around your area, find restaurants that perhaps have an interest in serving sustainable meat, or see if there's any cooperative groups that are practicing in your area before you begin this on any sizable economic scale, would be my main pointer. The other thing I would say is don't be afraid to look to examples that you may find in Europe. Europe is so far ahead of the United States in sustainable livestock production. They have done a much better job than us in getting government assistance and stimulus to help small farmers and find the right practices and methodologies. So don't be afraid to look online and find research that's been done in Europe, or even, as I did, just get on a plane and you know, tour the countryside of Denmark or England, and you'll see a lot of small country farm shop retail settings that farmers are doing innovative things at, and ask questions and make connections. You may learn a lot.
And to all those eaters out there, keep eating pigs, and we'll keep raising them. And another point is, Benjamin Franklin, who was one of our leading leaders of early times, he said, every farm can afford at least one pig, and no farm can afford none. So if you're farming out there somewhere and you're listening to this show, heed the words of our ancestors and forefathers, and get yourself a pig. Thanks so much, Jude, for joining us. Please stay in touch with us and the Greenhorns, www.thegreenhorns.net. Come visit our blog. Come listen to past shows and future ones. And thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Severin.